This episode is brought to you by National Geographic, presenting its new documentary film, Endurance. Follow the greatest survival story ever told, unpacking the legendary feat of polar explorer Sir Ernest Shackleton, who kept his crew alive for over a year despite losing their ship in frigid pack ice. Over a century later, a team of modern-day explorers set out to find the sunken ship. Endurance, now streaming on Hulu and Disney+.
When you think about super successful businesses that are selling through the roof, like Heinz or Mattel, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But there's a secret. The business behind the business making selling simple for them and buying simple for their customers. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout as Heinz and Mattel. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/promo, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/promo to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/promo.
This episode is brought to you by Allstate. Some people just know they could save hundreds on car insurance by checking Allstate first. Like you know to check the date of the big game first, before you accidentally buy tickets on your 20th wedding anniversary and have to spend the next 20 years of your marriage making up for it. Yeah, checking first is smart. So check Allstate first for a quote that could save you hundreds. You're in good hands with Allstate. Savings vary. Terms apply. Allstate Fire and Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Northbrook, Illinois.
The Green Belt is a much-loved thing. 6 in 10 Britons want to keep it, no matter how bad housing shortages get. Though on the other hand, more than a quarter of us believe that more than half of England has already been built on. It's actually 5 to 10%, depending how you define built on.
Summertown, Botley, Littlemore, Cowley and Headington were all separate villages, and Headington today is buried fathoms deep beneath a vast red brick ocean of bungalows, council estates, and prefabs.
The Green Belt is a powerful symbol of rural England, and Labour knows it. The new government says it wants to build on unlovely bits of Green Belts, and a lot of people don't like that.
In Sevenoaks, we are 93% Green Belt, yet we are constantly inundated by speculative planning applications which worry the local community. Yeah. The answer should be clear. If it's Green Belt, it's protected. If it's a speculative planning application, the answer is no.
Hear, hear.
First aid.
Well, I'd hate to be a developer facing the Honourable Lady. My Honourable Friend.
That was Laura Trott, who's just been re-elected MP for Sevenoaks, and the former Housing Secretary, Michael Gove. But who decided there should be green belts? How did they get so big? And how is the government ever going to overcome the opposition of homeowners who treasure their views and have absolutely no personal interest in house prices falling? I'm Ros Taylor, and this is Jam Tomorrow. The Labour politician Herbert Morrison was one of the people who believed there was a need for a green belt around London. In 1964, he explained why.
I speak with a feeling and sincerity about this, because the green belt was an invention of the London County Council at the time when I was leader. Therefore, I am, so to speak, something of a father of the green belt around London. Greater London is a vast built-up area. It is, I think, agreed by everybody, including Her Majesty's government, that in fact it is too big, that it ought never to have been allowed to become as big as it is as a built-up area. The consequence of this is that people of all classes, but especially people who have not their own motor transport or people who do not like driving motor cars in long queues and getting choked up on a Sunday when they come back, have quite a journey to make to get from the inner boroughs of London out into the green, natural countryside. The journey there and the journey back may undo all the advantage of the day, or part of the day, spent in the countryside, which they have enjoyed.
But the whole idea began in Vienna. Paul Cheshire is the Emeritus Professor of Economic Geography at the London School of Economics.
There are a lot of myths about the Green Belt. One of those myths is that it's a wonderful post-war invention and it's a wonderful British invention. The reality of the Green Belt is actually the first idea for Green Belt was when the old city of Vienna brought down its city walls in the late 1850s when sort of bourgeois civic mindedness was coming to the fore and people said, why don't you make this nice circular area around Vienna into a park? Which ultimately they more or less did, it's still there, it's called the Ringstrasse. And that influenced people in Britain on the old London County Council in the 1870s and emerged ultimately in a plan in 1919, the London Plan, where the idea was very simple. It would be a small circular area of park open to the public for green lungs of London, joining up places like Hampstead Heath and Richmond Park and Blackheath, and really a relatively small area, but very much for recreation and amenity. And that lasted until the Second World War in the 1938. In fact, the old LCC, London County Council, managed to get an Act of Parliament passed, allowing them to purchase land for public use for the future London Greenbelt. And they bought 20,000 hectares of land, a lot of it in Bromley and in Havering, which is why we've got two London boroughs, which are more than half of them covered by Greenbelt land, because it still went to the boroughs when the GLC was invented. So right up until after the Second World War, the idea was still that it was essentially a recreational area of green space and relaxation. But that changed when the Greenbelt was actually introduced. And this is another of the myths. The myth is that the Labour Party introduced it. Far from that, it was a rather right-wing Tory Secretary of State for Housing and Local Government, Duncan Sands, who introduced it in 1955. And then it was repurposed as essentially a way of penning London and Londoners in and keeping them out of the home counties and maintaining the home counties as the green pleasant shires. So instead of just being a relatively restricted area encircling London, it turned into an area which then was 17 times the area of the LCC, extending from the North Sea to the edge of Aylesbury, more than half a million hectares of land. So it's been completely changed. And the only purpose, I mean, as Duncan Sands wrote, encouraging local councils to designate greenbelts, even if neither green nor particularly attractive scenically, the major function of the greenbelt is to stop further development. So that is its only function, which was confirmed in the recent National Planning Policy Framework. It has no environmental function, no habitat preservation function, no biodiversity function, and it's private land, so it doesn't even have much of a recreational function. And that, if you like, is another myth. Its name, it's itself a myth. It's not green particularly. It's varied shades. Some of it's green, and those are mostly in areas of outstanding natural beauty, like in the Chilterns of the North Downs. Some of it has been remarked a grey. Indeed, some of it's pretty black, I'd say.
Here's Conservative peer and Minister Lord Elton in 1959, lamenting the new suburbs of Oxford. He was the man who got the classic 1929 red phone box listed.
Only the other day, as the historian counts time, Summertown, Botley, Littlemore, Cowley and Headington were all separate villages with their own village life and their own village personality. I myself lived for a good while at Headington, when Headington was still a small, ancient and characterful village. We escaped from it, like Lot from the doomed cities of the plain, in the nick of time, though fortunately without the episode of the Pillar of Salt. And Headington today is buried fathoms deep beneath a vast red brick ocean of bungalows, council estates and prefabs. It has ceased to be Headington and has not become Oxford. A community has disappeared, and nothing yet recognisable has taken its place. The widespread and irresistible process of ironing out individuality has achieved one more triumph.
True, these villages were gone forever. Summertown now has a Gales bakery, and you can stay in Premier Inns in Botley and Cowley. But if the Green Belt is not altogether green, as Paul Cheshire says, what is it used for?
The biggest single form of land use in most green belts is intensive agriculture, which of course is one of the most environmentally unfriendly activities, with almost no biodiversity which we engage in. So something nearly 40% of London's greenbelt is intensive agriculture. 75% of Cambridge's greenbelt is intensive agriculture. And it's mainly private land. Of course, it contains within it areas of outstanding natural beauty, sites of special scientific interest, etc. But those are quite independently and separately designated and preserved. So building on the greenbelt in no way means that you're building on sites of special scientific interest or anything that's very green.
And how much of it is golf courses?
Well, I can't tell you how much of all greenbelt. There's more than 1.6 million hectares of land, which is greenbelt, which is a bit more than 1.25 times as much land as is covered by all our cities and towns and urban development.
That's an extraordinary statistic, isn't it?
It is extraordinary, because people have, this is a myth, you know, people think it's a small island and we're in danger of concreting over the countryside. There isn't enough concrete in Europe to concrete over the greenbelt in London, because the greenbelt in London is 23,500 hectares and contains within it an area of golf courses. This is inside the GLA boundaries, an area of golf courses which is more than twice as big as the area of Kensington and Chelsea. So it's a huge area of golf courses, because of course if it's greenbelt land you can turn it into golf courses quite easily, but you cannot build on it, so there's no competition. If you go to New York, land for golf courses is expensive and playing golf is expensive. But in London, it's almost free. So more of Surrey is covered by golf courses than is covered by houses or domestic buildings.
Blinds.com is kicking off the savings early with Black Friday mega deals all month long. A Blinds.com design expert can help you make the perfect selection on your schedule. We can even handle everything from measure to your whole home install for just one low cost. With over 25 million windows covered, Blinds.com is the number one online retailer of custom window coverings. Save up to 45% on select styles, plus a free professional measure right now at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
When launching a new product, finding the right revenue model can be just as important as the product itself. That's why Stripe built Stripe Billing. Stripe Billing is the advanced billing software to grow any business. From seat-based subscriptions to usage-based billing, and every pricing model in between, Stripe Billing helps you grow your business your way fast. Learn how Stripe Billing can help your business at stripe.com/billing.
Ryan Reynolds here for, I guess, my 100th Mint commercial. No, don't. I mean, honestly, when I started this, I thought I'd only have to do like 4 of these. I mean, it's unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month. How are there still people paying 2 or 3 times that much? I'm sorry, I shouldn't be victim blaming here. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/save, whenever you're ready.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
Why, then, is the Green Belt so abidingly popular? John Elledge is a journalist and the author of A History of the World in 47 Borders, the stories behind the lines on our maps.
I think it's a couple of things. I think one of them is it's an incredibly successful piece of branding. Like, you hear the words Greenbelt, it sounds nice, it sounds pretty. Like, it's always illustrated in newspapers with pictures of things like the Chilterns or the South Downs, which are generally, I mean, sometimes they are Greenbelt, but they're generally also areas of outstanding natural beauty, which is a whole different categorisation. And a lot of the Greenbelt does not, in fact, look like that. But it sounds like it should. It's also very easily conflated with Greenfield, which just means undeveloped land. Like, people often sort of think greenbelt and brownfield are opposites, and they're not. Like, you can get greenbelt that is also brownfield. So part of it is, like, it's just a name that it's very difficult to make the argument against. If you say you oppose the greenbelt, you sound mad. I think there's also something almost sort of primal about identity in there, in that the purpose of the Greenbelt, you know, partly it was about kind of keeping cities and their existing boundaries, kind of encourage regeneration of land rather than sort of continuing overspill. Part of it was to stop the massive expansion of our towns and cities that happened between the wars very quickly in an unplanned manner. But another purpose was to stop towns from merging into each other. And I think this is what I mean about it being primal. I think it's very important to people that they're from Bradford, not Leeds, or Birmingham, not Coventry. And so the idea of these places physically merging together kind of undermines that. So you end up with people defending this. I think the greenbelt between Bradford and Leeds is literally like a field or something. It's like the two are essentially one city, but it makes people kind of like very, very protective of the slight sliver that remains. Plus, there is just the most basic thing, which I've left to last because it's the most obvious, that, you know, people like fields. They don't like the noise of construction work and the fact it's going to inconvenience them. They like having a view over some green stuff where they can walk the dog through, and they don't want it replaced by housing. So I think those things kind of account for most of its kind of totemic status. But I really think the branding is kind of an underrated factor here. And I think that's actually Labour being quite clever in attacking that now.
How much of a say should people have in their surroundings if they've bought a house with a view across fields? Don't they have a right to see that as part of the value of their property?
Yes, of course. But, you know, firstly, there are limits. Like, you know, it's not part of your property. It's something nice that comes with it. And sometimes the things that are nice that come with a property, you lose through no fault of your own. Like, you might buy a house because you like that it's got easy access to a particular pub or shop that can close. You know, it's like things happen. You sometimes have to deal with it. There's also an argument that, you know, maybe with stuff with a kind of more direct value, I think perhaps we are sometimes a bit stingy about not compensating people better. I think also the CPO terms are a bit weak. So I think, like, if we kind of made sure we were giving people enough money to accept change, I think that would make it easier. But I also think, like, the problem with saying, like, you know, don't they have a right to see that as part of the value of their property is, like, are we really comfortable saying that only owner-occupiers have those kind of rights? What about the rights of people who are stuck in rental properties, or the rights of people who are still kids? Or something? You know, like, they also should have a right to secure housing that is currently being stymied by our inability to build. In terms of, like, how much of a say people should have in their surroundings, I think like the problem is that we need to balance conflicting interests, don't we? As things stand, you know, you think local people do have an interest in whether or not homes are built in their area. But that shouldn't be able to completely overwhelm the interests of those who do not have homes, who may wish to move to the area. It's sort of weirdly nativist to kind of suggest that only the people who already live in a town should have any say over the future of that town. So, like, it's not that I think there should be no democratic oversight or no consultation in the process. I think that would be monstrous. But I don't think you have to look very far for signs that we've kind of overshot in terms of protecting the interests of the people who already live in an area who, by and large, don't want to build, rather than the interests of the people who would benefit from building and of the broader economy. I mean, it's not just visible in house prices, but in demographics and the fact that family formation is happening later and birth rates are down. In terms of, like, I think one of the answers to the productivity puzzle, the reason why we, you know, wages have really not grown in 15 years is because it's so difficult to kind of build the factories or the lab space or the, you know, the physical infrastructure required to kind of boost the economy. We're not building solar panels or energy infrastructure at the rate we should be. We have a planning system that very much privileges the rights of people to say no, and never the reasons why we should say yes.
And is it also about time? Do the kind of people who tend to object to these developments, they have a lot more time than your average working person, don't they?
They do. I really like the euphemism on show there. Yeah, no, there is. You have to be careful here because I do think there is a danger of getting into politically contentious areas. But it is by and large true that NIMBY campaigners often tend to be they tend to be people who are settled in an area, who maybe are kind of out of the working economy, who have time to focus on other interests. I'm basically saying they tend to be retired people. And they have a different set of economic interests to people in their 20s, 30s, 40s. And what has happened in British politics in the last 15 years or so that's never really happened before is we've kind of had the sort of age has replaced class as the determinant of your vote. So once upon a time, like wherever you were, you know, we had generally a two-party system. And if you were kind of towards the bottom of the income scale, you were most likely to vote Labour. And if you were towards the top, you were most likely to vote Tory. There were obviously exceptions and so on, but that was basically the rule. Now, instead of class, it's age. So generally speaking, the older you get, the more likely you are to vote Tory. And I'm not clear on the sort of mechanism between cause and effect here. I'm not sure whether, like, this is because Tories started chasing those votes or the Tories started chasing those votes because that was happening anyway. But we've ended up in a position where over the last couple of election cycles, the Tories have been completely dominated by the older voter. That's their base. And by and large, if you're 70, if you already own your home, the fact that someone might stick a pylon or a new estate in that field you can see from your window, that's ruinous to you. And it doesn't matter to you that, like, not doing so is affecting the life chances of younger people or hurting the economy as a whole. Like, you know, obviously a lot of older people will be like, oh, they worry about their kids or grandkids not being able to get on the ladder. But I don't think people easily grasp the link between the economic opportunities available to their kids and grandkids and their own desire to block housing development. I think there are too many links in the chain for people to immediately grasp that. And often, like, if you look at pictures of NIMBY campaign groups, they do tend to be quite grey. So I do think it is often, it's almost a sort of hobby activity for a lot of people, I think.
Is this an intergenerational issue fundamentally? Do older homeowners have a moral obligation to stop preventing new housing?
I don't want to bring morals and ethics into it. I just want to look at it sort of in the cold light of reason. The reality is that it's in the interests of older house owners, particularly if they've paid off their mortgages, to be opposed to new housing. That process means that home ownership and even anywhere decent to live has become more and more unattainable. So age of buying a first house is now in the late 30s. Proportion of homeowners has fallen from over 70% 25 years ago to now about 64%. And of course, more people having to live at home. The rate of younger people and young couples living in their parental home has increased by 7% a year over the last 10 years. We don't build enough houses. So whilst home ownership by the over 75s has actually increased in the last 10 years. So there is, it's an increasing generational divide, and I'm not pleased about it because it's a real social divisive issue. And for young people, it is a really serious issue. But what is happening over time is that the number of people who are priced out, if you like, of the housing market is increasing, so their political clout is increasing. And the only way you're going to get a change is if some political party has the vision and the vigour to take it on and say this is something that is causing serious social division and inequality. It's also damaging economic growth because people can't get houses near to where the jobs are, and therefore reforms the system. So I don't think it's a question of moral obligation. I personally am a huge financial beneficiary from the status quo. I own a house up the road that's worth an enormous amount of money, but it's not a benefit to me because I'd only cash in on the money if I sold my house. I don't want to. So I don't think it's a moral obligation, but I think it's a political and an economically vital thing to do.
Are you optimistic that the Labour government will bite the bullet on this?
One of the advantages that Labour government has is that it's learnt or grown out of the idea that somehow the Greenbelt was a Labour invention. The Greenbelt, originally before the Second World War, was a Labour ideal, if you like, a socialist visionary ideal. But when it was actually implemented, it was a Tory implementation and a Tory idea, and Labour voters don't tend to live in the Greenbelt. So I think the political cost to the Labour Party of building more houses is much smaller than they have probably thought it was in the past. So I hope they do, but unfortunately I think their plans in many ways are not very radical. They are more persuasive, if you like, there's more substance to them than anything anybody else has come up with, but only if they really have a serious about having a strategic review of the Greenbelt and releasing some of it for housing, only then will they really be able to change the situation.
Labour say they want to build on what they call the grey belt bits of the Greenbelt. What does that actually mean, and how hard is it going to be for them to do that?
So I think this is a fantastic idea, but I would, because although I didn't come up with the branding, I have been writing columns basically saying you should build on rubbish bits of Greenbelt for about a decade now. I'd love to be able to tell you they got this from me, but I think it's more. I've been working in this kind of area, but I think we have as a movement kind of persuaded the Labour Party, so I'm taking some credit for that. Coming back to the branding, the thing with the Greenbelt is it sounds like it's all lovely, and a lot of it isn't. It will include, you know, disused quarries or petrol stations or industrial architecture that's been left to rot, but because it's Greenbelt, it's incredibly difficult to redevelop it. And this is what I mean about some Greenbelt is brownfield, and people don't realise that. But there's a lot of Greenbelt that doesn't kind of fit the image people have of it. And that, to me, feels like the obvious sort of thing we should be building on, because you're not losing proper countryside. You're just losing places that are a bit rubbish already. So that is what Keir Starmer means when he refers to Greybelt. Like, that's been quite explicit. In terms of how easy that's going to be, I don't know yet. So there are practical concerns, one of which is there's no definition of Greybelt. Like, that's a political label. That's not a term in the planning system. So there's going to have to be some work done to identify what that might mean. And that feels like you could either end up with it locked into sort of this contentious ongoing consultation where there's kind of lots of chances to weaken it and nothing really happens for several years. Or if you don't do that, you risk not having political support, because people will be like, well, we don't trust you when you say it's Greybelt. We think this is just a land grab. The other problem in there is political. I mean, I imagine by the time this comes out, the election would have happened. But as we speak, it's about a week before election day. It is not clear which seats Labour is going to hold, but it does look a lot like it is going to suddenly win a lot of Greenbelt seats it has never held before. And that is going to mean pressure within the party to not build on those seats necessarily. And questions over whether Keir Starmer can hold his nerve on that. You know, you have to be willing to risk short-term unpopularity on the assumption that it will make the economy better. It will, you know, you will create a generation of grateful voters who eventually get to own their own homes, and they will stick with you as the right-to-buy generation has largely stuck with the Tories. But all these are kind of long-term things. And in the short term, you're going to lose midterm elections. You're going to lose all your councillors. That is what's going to happen. So it's not clear as we speak how easy this is going to be. I do think it is striking that Keir Starmer has stuck his neck out here when, you know, he's not necessarily been politically brave on a number of issues. Let's be honest. He's trying to avoid fights, particularly with what are obnoxiously being referred to as hero voters, and they tend to be sort of the people who used to vote Labour and then voted Brexit and Tory, who do tend to be the kind of older voter who will generally not want houses built. This is one of the few areas in which Keir Starmer has said explicitly, like, you know, the interests of those people is not what I'm worried about right now. So he has kind of shown some nerve. Whether he keeps it in office, I don't know. I have also been arguing for some time that, do you remember when the Tories came in 2010 and a lot of the austerity was devolved to councils, and they came up with a council cuts formula, and would you believe it, the biggest cuts fell on Labour councils by some shocking coincidence. I wonder if there is room to do something similar. And so the area is foolish enough to still return Conservative or Liberal Democrat MPs. Oh, would you? So apparently we're building a housing estate here. I don't know how that happened, but I don't know if that's actually what they're going to do.
Act of revenge.
Yeah.
Do you think it's going to be a case of addressing people's objections on a case-by-case basis, you know, saying, right, this bit is Greybelt, we're going to build here? Or is there something that the new government could do that would address NIMBYism more broadly?
I mean, I think the Greybelt thing is good. I think that shows an understanding that part of the issue here is language and the way we talk about this stuff. And just, I know I keep coming back to this, but Greenbelt is such a good bit of branding because it's so hard to oppose. It does sound like, do you want London just sprawling indefinitely? Do you just want developers to be able to concrete over the Garden of England? No, of course you don't. It makes, you know, it makes it a very difficult political case to make. So like, attacking that is good, I think. One thing you can do is, we're quite unusual in having a system whereby like every individual planning application has to go through a full system of consultation and can be rejected by the council and so on. Most countries have a more zoning-based system where, like, there will be exceptions. Like, if you want to do something outside the rules, you can still kind of apply for it and go through this stuff. But, like, if you're just building a home that kind of fits in with the rules already laid down for an area, no one can stop you. It's like, you have a perfect right to do that because this area is zoned for residential or three stories. You can build your mansard. You can build a new home. So like, I think we moving in that direction would not only kind of make it easier in and of itself, because it would kind of like, you know, free up a lot of time at councils, council planning committees, and it would make it easier for kind of developers to get through. It would also, by the way, free up smaller developers to build. Like one of the reasons we have like five or six massive house building companies that do almost everything is because the planning system is so expensive to navigate that, you know, if you're a small builder, you can't just like build three houses a year or something. You know, you need to be one of these big guys and be able to afford lawyers. But the other advantage of kind of shifting to a zoning system would be like, it would sort of establish the fact that I don't want this. It should not necessarily be a politically meaningful statement. Like, there are a lot of things that have happened in politics the last few years that I have not particularly wanted, and I have railed against them, but I have not imagined that my objections should in and of itself be a reason they're not going to happen. And the thing about the planning system as it stands at the moment is it does tell people, you have a perfect right to say, I don't want this, and therefore stop it. I think changing the planning system so that, like, these campaigns are by and large doomed will kind of change the mentality around this stuff so that people don't imagine they can just say no and therefore hold the entire country back. You know, if you move to a system where it's kind of rules-based rather than objections-based, I think that would benefit us in a number of ways. But again, it's not clear to me that that is what Starmer & Co are currently planning.
Time to move? Skip the hassles of selling during the holiday season and sell your home directly to Opendoor. Request an all-cash offer in minutes, close, and get paid in days. You can even pick your close date so you can move after New Year's. Start your move at opendoor.com or download the Opendoor app. Opendoor is represented by Opendoor Brokerage, Inc., license 02061130 in California, and Opendoor Brokerage, LLC in its other markets. Terms and conditions apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Ralph's. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Ralph's. Fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
In 2019, Paul Cheshire worked up a practical proposal for a leasing land for development on the Greenbelt.
Yeah, so the idea is really, I mean, it seems like a no-brainer. I mean, we know that the most energy-efficient form of transport is rail transport. We also know that building new rail infrastructure is exceedingly expensive. We've just found that at huge cost in terms of HS2. So there is no development in Britain, and hasn't been for a very long time, which financially could justify new railway. Small areas in very expensive bits of London have been justified tube extensions. So the obvious idea is to make the best use of the rail infrastructure and capacity that you've got. And since you can find a room to put a million houses within 800 metres of commuter stations in the London Greenbelt, that is, their stations which just got frozen in time, left behind by the Second World War when development stopped, for example, in Northwood and parts of that area of London, or golf courses just over the boundary. I know a derelict golf course near Knockholt, 30 minutes from London Bridge Station, but it's in the Greenbelt, so you can't build on it, and it's an eyesore because it's just derelict. So the idea is to build on land around commuter stations, and that would release enough land for a million houses in the London area, or over just five big cities, 2 million houses.
And you think that could reduce the amount of subsidy paid to rail companies, which would obviously be welcome news to the government. How would that work?
Well, the idea there is that, you know, of course, there's this huge, because land for building is in such scarce supply, it's exceedingly expensive. So if you could get planning permission to build on a hectare of land in, say, Barnet, which is presently in the Greenbelt, so you can't build on it, and there were no planning obligations attached to that, you'd probably get £35 million a hectare, whereas its agricultural value is maybe £30-40 million a hectare, including hope value. So the idea would be to pass the rights to develop land to what I call a green development corporation, which would have its remit to organise a structural plan for developing all this land that was available around commuter stations in coordination with the rail infrastructure, and then provide a financial incentive to the rail company out of this land value capture, because you'd be buying land at something I would argue you should buy it voluntarily, not compulsory purchase it, so pay a little bit more than the agricultural value, but since no one else could develop it, you'd have a monopoly, you'd be able to buy it quite cheaply, and then sell it on for development and use the difference in price, partly to provide infrastructure for the new housing and services, public services, and partly to provide additional subsidies, commuter rail, to expand the rail system to accommodate the new housing development.
So that would help to pay for the things like schools, GPs, that people complain whenever there's a new development, people complain that there aren't enough of those things and that the existing ones will be overwhelmed. Are there other ways we could do that?
I mean, this is one of the other reasons why we have, it's not just the Green Belt, it's not just the planning system. Another reason we have such a shortage of houses is because, in effect, our local government finance system fines a local community that allows houses to be built, because they have an obligation to provide additional school places, road services, medical establishments, etc. But they get no funding from the government because council tax is such a tiny fraction of local authority revenues. So, yes, what you can do, and works in some other countries, for example, is you can provide a financial incentive to local communities via tax revenues or land value capture to pay for these additional services that get crowded when you have new residents. So you could have what they have in America, an impact fee, for example, where the developer has to pay an amount determined by the rules of the game, if you like, which are what is justified in terms of additional infrastructure to make sure that people don't suffer from the development. And they pay that as part of the price of making the development. And you can show that communities that impose impact fees are more willing to accept new housing than those that don't. Or, for example, in Switzerland, you have a local income tax. So you have a local income tax, so the local authority gains some new revenues from new residents. So it's perfectly happy to have more building.
Possibly an idea for the new Labour government.
Well, yes, but you have to tie the revenues to actually providing the services which get crowded and congested as a result of additional residents.
The CPRE, which calls itself the Countryside Charity and campaigns very, very strongly for the Green Belt, it acknowledges the housing shortage, but it says that houses built on the Green Belt wouldn't be affordable, so they shouldn't be built. What is your response to that?
Well, I'm very old and I used to read something called the Manchester Guardian, which you may have heard of.
Used to work for it.
A nice, liberal, well-meaning paper, which was hugely in favour of the right to strike, but as was pointed out, had never actually supported any strikes ever. So this is rather like CPRE. They're in favour of building housing, but they've never actually been known to support building any particular housing. You know, the CPR is essentially a lobby for the Green Belt, and its members are disproportionately representative of people who have the privilege of living in the Green Belt. So if you own a house that's in the Green Belt, you get an advantage. You get green space around you, but you're also paying a premium, and it's an asset, part of your financial assets. So people who live in the Green Belt are hugely protective of it and its continuing existence. They join the CPRE. Members of the CPRE generally have got a house. Maybe some of them have even got more than one house. So I'm not all that persuaded by the arguments of a group who exists in order to stop building in the Green Belt. And, you know, economics 101 tells you that if you don't build enough houses, the price goes up. And that's what's happened. And you build more houses in the Green Belt, yeah, they'll be expensive houses because they are surrounded by decent landscape, probably. Unless you build them around stations, in which case they'll be more expensive because they're close to good transport.
The Green Belt is a Labour policy rooted in a belief that ordinary people should be able to spend a day in the countryside at the weekend. But now it's a policy that boosts the property values of the homeowners who live in it. The Green Belt plays directly into fears about what Britain might become if it builds new housing for its rising population. So can the party that created it overcome our powerful attachment to these huge tracts of, mostly, open space? How will the people living there react if their objections are overruled? We are about to find out.
Only the other day, as the historian counts time.
I'm Roz Taylor, and that was Jam Tomorrow. If you enjoyed the start of Season 3 of Jam Tomorrow, have you listened to Season 2? In their heyday, women's magazines sold 12 million copies a week. And at their best, these magazines changed women's lives. They advised, they inspired, they gave us a glimpse of a different way of being, and that was as true of Cosmopolitan as it was of the feminist magazine Spare Rib. In the previous episode of Jam Tomorrow, I spoke to women who created these magazines about a disappearing world. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a quick review. We really appreciate it. See you next time.
Jam Tomorrow was written and presented by Roz Taylor. The producer was me, Jade Bailey. Additional voiceover work was by Seth Tavor. Music was by Dubstar, and artwork was by Jim Parrott. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. Jam Tomorrow is a Podmasters production.